This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. Did you know that olive oil is at its peak of flavor and nutrition right after it's fresh pressed at harvest time? That's why my favorite olive oil is delivered to me direct from the latest harvest, thanks to the Fresh Pressed Olive Oil Club. And now you can try a bottle yourself, normally $39, for just $1, with no obligation to buy anything else. Visit myfavoriteoliveoil.com. In my case, it truly is. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. MyFavoriteOliveOil.com. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Roland Hoffman. It's a time of week that I very much look forward to because I get a chance to discourse with my colleague, Layla Mutin, who's our nutritionist in residence, and Grist for the Mill, our questions that you send to us via radio program at AOL.com. And we've got a bunch of questions this week, so thank you for taking an interest. And before we get to questions, interesting story in the news that just came out today. Drinking fluoridated water during pregnancy may lower IQ in sons, controversial study says.
Wow.
Yeah, so this is a battle that we've been fighting for quite some time about the hazards of fluoridation. And you know, frankly, being anti-fluoridation can get you branded as a nutcase. Because, I remember, this has been going on ever since I was a little kid. There were these people who were talking about fluoridation, that it was like a communist plot, that it was stealing our virility, and it was a little bit like the little old lady in tennis shoes from Pasadena, who was a conspiracy theory, was talking about fluoridation when I was like a kid.
Uh-huh.
It sort of fits in with people's view that there's some sort of monolithic state conspiracy to undermine our health by adding these unacceptable additives to our water supply against our will, against our free will.
Mm-hmm.
And the people of the scientific community and dentists especially pushed back against this. They said this is the greatest thing, the greatest public health advancement since vaccines. It's a wonderful thing because we've curbed the epidemic of dental caries. Mm-hmm. Fluoridation is an unqualified success. The incidence of dental caries is going down because of fluoridation. But there are other people who, over the years have pointed out that fluoride is a toxin.
Yes.
And also there's an element of, follow the money trail, because it turns out that the aluminum industry, relatively new industry in America, it got a big impetus, by the way, in World War II because of lightweight aircraft materials, making aluminum. And then, of course, maybe less need for bombers and fighter planes. And so they created the aluminum siding industry. And
right.
The aluminum foil industry. Uh-huh. They kept making a lot of aluminum. It's a marvelous substance. It's flexible. It's light. But when you make aluminum, you end up with a big slag of fluoride residue.
And what are they going to do with that?
What are you going to do with that? All that toxic stuff. We're going to put it into the water supply.
Oh, well, you were going to dump it anyway.
Right.
We could say.
So anyway, over the years, this has been a hot and heavy controversy. So they published an article, and they actually apologized for this article. They said, we're sorry, in a way, to publish this because it's going to feed the nutcase people who are against fluoridation. But we have to admit that this is good science. It was a well-conducted study.
Okay.
Rigorously controlled. Mm-hmm. And it does show fluoridated drinking water, when taken in pregnancy, increases the risk for a decline in IQ points in boys, but not in girls.
I was just going to ask, because the title of that struck me as strange. And what, they only looked at boys, but not, okay.
No,
they didn't find the same thing.
They didn't find the same thing as girls. So a lot of people, it's very controversial, people saying, that's ridiculous. How can that possibly be? that something is toxic for boys, but not for girls.
Hmm.
And so that invalidates the study. If it was really toxic, you would show up in both boys and girls. But interestingly, the incidence of autism is much higher in boys.
That's true.
Boys seem to be more vulnerable to the effects, potentially, of environmental toxins for some reason. And so maybe this is real. We'll talk more about this, and I may write a little article about this. The authors, they say, are fully aware of the controversial nature of their work, and one of them, Dr. Rivka Green, a neuropsychology doctoral student at York University in Toronto, Canada, says she hopes the study will jumpstart further research. We tried to be as cautious and careful as possible, she says. We're not coming and saying that fluoride is poison or anything like that. We're just letting the data tell the story. So, they JAMA Pediatrics took the unusual step of publishing an editor's note accompanying the paper. You know, they did that also with the chelation study. When the chelation study came out showing that chelation actually worked, they said, well, we're sorry, but, you know, we don't want to give credence to this quackery of chelation. But we have to admit that the study actually shows that it works, so we're publishing it as much, you know, it's
I hate all this apologizing.
Yeah.
We want truth in science. There should be no apology for that.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So
there's lots of problems with fluoride.
Yeah.
Competes with iodine for uptake by the thyroid.
Yeah.
Let's get started here. Maybe that has something to do with our, I don't want to call it an epidemic of hypothyroidism, but why is it that after a certain age, or more often than not, we're seeing more and more hypothyroidism?
Yeah, and also many countries and municipalities have backed away from fluoridation for that reason. They actually think that there's something called the precautionary principle, which is it's one thing to say, well, there's not enough evidence to conclusively demonstrate that fluoride is a problem.
Hmm.
But under the precautionary principle, if there's even a, suggestion of an effect, why go there? It's an additive. It's not like
It's
you're going that extra mile to add the fluoride. So why go the extra mile to add something that is potentially problematic?
Right. It may also be problematic for our bones.
Yeah. Dental fluorosis means there's a mottling of the teeth. Too much fluoride damages the teeth, and too much fluoride damages the bone.
Yes.
It's actually
bone mineral density.
It's actually one of those things that actually increases bone mineral density but makes the bones more brittle.
Ah.
So it was actually
what's
proposed as an osteoporosis treatment because it made the bones look denser, but they were more brittle.
Hmm.
So,
interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, to be continued, but it's interesting how it's going to really take, we got to turn around the Titanic here because the momentum towards the iceberg is so profound that even with early warnings, we're still headed for the iceberg with these environmental toxins. Even with glyphosate, they're pushing back, You know, there's a big PR campaign by Monsanto.
And even other pesticides, herbicides, or anything in the environment that was even banned back in the 70s are still showing up in pregnant women's placentas after birth and all of that. And yeah, it's very concerning. And how do we clear all of that?
So I'm going to take some no-dos and stay up late one night and read the paper,
Stay up and read the paper.
Or have an extra, take some extra theanine or something so I can, as a focus factor, so that I can, my eyes won't glaze over when I read all that data and see if I can discern the truth or lack thereof in the study. Because, frankly, there are a lot of studies that point to this or that or the other thing, and they don't amount to a hill of beans because the methodology is suspect.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Did they say anything about their N number or anything? How many subjects they
I haven't gotten there yet.
All right. Look forward to that article, Dr. Hoffman.
For an article that controversial to be published, it's got to be a pretty darn good study because the bias against a study like that would be great. So it must have been overwhelmingly rigorous for them to even publish it.
Yeah.
That's my suspicion. It's not a fly-by-night study because if it was fly, they'd be saying, oh, another anti-fluoridation study by these fluoridation nuts, they're back again, we'll deep sick. They had to pay attention to the study.
That's okay. That's very compelling. Looking forward to your synopsis on that. All right, we've got a very nice email, Dr. Hoffman, for you from Geraldine. She writes, "Hi, thought you would like to hear about your life-changing impact on one of your followers. He's a nutritionist who works in a nutritionally oriented store here in Brooklyn, in New York. He told me he decided to go into this field because of his fascination with your radio show, which he's listened to for over 13 years. He visits your website, listens to your podcast, read your articles, etc. He considers you his mentor. He obviously cares for his customers and wants to help them. He attributes it all to your influence. I'm pretty sure he is one of many whom you have influenced." That is pretty special.
Well, that
what a lovely
that is,
note.
What a lovely note and a wonderful tribute. And I'm going to pass along a tribute because I actually, when I was young and aspiring in this field, I had role models too.
Yeah.
And among them were Carlton Fredericks,
yes,
and Gary Null and Dr. Atkins and... Yeah. You know, and I listened to them, and I was inspired by them. Mm-hmm. And there's an element of, you know, two elements to these broadcasts. One is, you know, the transmission of raw facts, and the other is the transmission of sort of an ethos of a critical look at American medicine and the way we deliver health and our food supply, and our environment. And I think that is part of the spirit of broadcasts like this, is to inculcate people with a spirit of inquiry and curiosity, and you know, just thinking it out for themselves.
Yeah.
And pursuing knowledge in this wonderful field that's
thinking.
Continually
yes.
Changing and developing.
Yeah.
So there's, you know, I'm just delighted if there's some people who just catch the fever of this. Movement.
Yeah. Yeah. A good fever to have, folks.
And you too are, you know, and Layla are contributing to that, because I think there are many people in your profession, you know, dietitians and master's degree nutritionists who say, wow, she's a role model. This is what you can do professionally in this field and, you know, achieve excellence in a field of endeavor. And to add to that, it's not even your first career.
No, this is my second career. This was a calling, and many of your same mentors were mine, starting actually way back even before I was conscious of it, Carlton Fredericks.
Yeah.
And then Dr. Atkins, and then so forth, and you, as a result, back in 2005. So here we are. It's so interesting. I was just explaining to a patient that we saw this morning, a young woman in college, is thinking of going into the sciences, and the person she was with in the office was explaining, you will gravitate towards things like Dr. Hoffman's podcasts. And I told her, I said, if you just listen to his Clinical Focus podcast, you will earn yourself at least an honorary
an honorary
PhD.
Degree, right.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So he said to her, in my presence, he says, if you don't find yourself gravitating to these kinds of things, then you know that it's not for you. But speaking of getting a fever about it, when I went back to school, I thought first that I was going to become a psychologist.
Right.
Because I have an interest in that. And you know what? Being nutritionists, we need to minor in psychology.
Guess what?
Yeah, we need psychology.
You are a psychologist. you know, I've
eating
seen
is
you,
a behavior.
I've seen you in action.
Oh my gosh.
Know, and, yeah.
We need to at least minor in psychology.
Yeah.
But here's the thing, and here's the epiphany that we were trying to explain to this young woman today, who's in college. I said, I was a psychology major and I was doing my work, until the day when in my mailbox I would find the Berkeley Health newsletter, the Tufts newsletter, Dr. Atkins' Health Revelations, Dr. Julian Whitaker's newsletter.
Yes.
These would all come around the same time every month. And when I saw them, I started to salivate. I'm salivating as I'm talking about it now.
Right.
Everything stopped.
Right.
Everything stopped, was put aside as I devoured these newsletters. And that there was the epiphany on my living room sofa.
Right.
Why aren't I studying nutrition?
Yep.
And then I had to, you know, go talk to my mother and talk to my sister and say, I should be studying nutrition.
I have the same reaction when I get my copy of the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition.
AKA?
Right?
right. Because I remember what you used to call it.
Yeah, it's kind of like my monthly Penthouse magazine.
Right,
you know?
Right.
But, you know,
but it's that kind of a thing, really.
I'm past that. You know?
Yes.
But I have a sense of excitement. And to my dismay, all of a sudden, it stopped. Mm-hmm. I was going to my mailbox and saying, I must be getting my American, or maybe they're going to give me like three issues because they haven't sent it to me for all spring.
Uh-huh.
And so I finally got through to them. It's very hard to get through to them. And they said, let's look you up. And I said, oh, your subscription expired in 2018. I said, oh my God, you know, then you're not billing me? He said, no, you changed credit cards or something.
Okay.
I said, well, get me back on, you know, so that I can get it. And, and some of these articles, frankly, these articles to a layperson would be very dry and, complex, but they are, you know, I try to search for nuggets of meaning and relevance in those articles that I can pass along to listeners.
The clinical pearls, yes, absolutely. So, okay, here's to our mentors. Okay, Geraldine, thank you for that lovely note. All right. We have an email. I don't have a name. Hello, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Sometimes I go for a run and can run my usual 6 miles as a 7.5 minute mile. No problem.
By the way, that's
fast.
That's good.
That's booking. That's a race.
Okay.
I call that a race. That's really something.
First of all, going 6 miles, that's not an inconsiderable feat. That's a 10K race.
Yeah.
And that's a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
So 7.5, good pace.
Wow.
Don't know how old this individual is.
Nope, we don't know. Mm-hmm. So I could run that one day, no problem. Then the very next day or so, I can run better than maybe 8.5 or a 9 minute mile, but I get out of breath very quickly. In other words, I'm not running as fast as I did the day before.
Right.
I'm still doing all right, but I'm
out of breath,
really. That is pretty good. I've had the full cardio workup and everything is normal. Any idea what could cause this on and off scenario?
Well,
I'm thinking there are so many possibilities.
So first of all, it's very good that he had a full cardiac workup. And
yes.
I presume that includes a stress test in particular, because that, you know, a slowdown or a decline in performance might mean some kind of blockage.
Yeah.
So presumably that's not there. Also, the other thing that's relevant is what's called an echocardiogram, which shows the status of the valves.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, forget running. Just, you know, people who experience a sudden decrement in their ability to, say, climb stairs or go up a hill. Maybe they're going up an incline in their neighborhood where they usually take their walk, and all of a sudden they're huffing and puffing. It may mean that they have an aortic valve problem or a mitral valve problem that's compromising their performance. I think that's what happened to Mick Jagger, because everybody
said... He got a valve replacement,
People said he was like gyrating like nobody's business, like he was amazing at his...
After the surgery.
After the surgery.
Oh,
he had a concert recently in New York. He was I think he was in the Garden, and he was in New Jersey at the MetLife. And he was... People say he was amazing. But at that very high level of performance, he probably noticed a little bit of a decline in his exertional capacity. And lo and behold, he got checked. And then they did a TAVRs procedure, which is a relatively non-invasive procedure to fix his valve. But he's all fixed up. At 70, whatever he is, 74 or something like that.
Well, 70 is a new 50. So
yeah. So that's what, you know, the basic things to check. Now, it gets a little more subtle. Like, well, there's nothing obvious. There's nothing, no plumbing problem in the heart.
Right.
What could be going on? And, you know, and I will relate from my own personal experience is that, you know, running, you know, especially past a certain age, running or doing the same thing day in, day out, you can have a little bit of fatigue, and it has to do with lactic acid accumulation in your muscles. And that will slow you down so that you'll feel, you know, sort of flat. Like sometimes after a weekend of very intense exercise, I'll do a spin class or something, I'll say, man, I don't have it today. I'm just going through the motions.
Mm-hmm. I'm thinking after a 6 mile run at 7.5 minute per mile,
you're generating lactic acid.
You were really, not just that, you're burning up a whole lot of glycogen.
That too.
Which you may have not then replenished enough after that run.
That could be.
for the following day. Right. So you're feeling a little flat.
Right. But, I mean, there's clearing of the lactic acid.
Yeah.
And then there's also replenishing your glycogen. So I don't know what the problem is with this individual. Maybe there's some discernible problem. But, you know, the suggestion is change your workout pattern.
Yeah. He says... Or she says, the very next day, I'm out of breath. Well, maybe you need a day off.
Yeah, that's typically, you know.
Do something different. And then try this. Do your 7.5 mile, 6 mile run, and then take a day off, and then see if the following day you could do another 7.5 minute mile.
I rarely do the same thing 2 days in a row. Now, this weekend was an exception. I did a 15 mile, which is for me a fairly short bike ride, you know, with hills.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I said, the next day was a beautiful day, and I said, you know, usually I don't want to do 2 days in a row on the bicycle, but let me push it. And I did a 30 mile. And I got to tell you that after doing the hill work 15 miles, the 30 mile was a little harder than usual.
Yeah.
But I felt exceptionally good that weekend. I pushed it. But, you know, the next day I really was not going to be set for another 30 mile bike ride.
Right, right. You need to take a day off from working those lower body muscles that you did so pedaling up the hills.
I went swimming and stuff.
Right? There
and,
you go.
And, you know.
Yeah.
So I just think people have to listen to the body. Maybe that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
That there's some fatigue factor here.
Yeah.
But hey, this is an embarrassment of riches. It's like, oh, I was only able to do an 8.5 to 9 minute
embarrassment
mile.
Of riches.
Yeah, you know what I'm saying? It's like, hey.
7.5 minute mile.
That's all good.
Oh.
Yeah. But, I mean, look, we're not talking like Olympic competition, but for the average amateur runner, especially like a, you know, over 50 runner, that's pretty darn good.
Right. We're not talking about Usain Bolt or something.
Yeah, but, right. Yeah. Well, or, you know, one of these, Ethiopian marathoners.
Oh, yeah.
They
don't even look like they're breathing while they're running.
The whole marathon, they'll do like five and change, you know.
Right, right. Okay, so not to worry. Take a day off. Don't attempt to do the very same thing the next day.
Yeah, I mean, that's my offhanded recommendation.
Right, right. But thank you for that email. Okay, we have an email from Cindy. Cindy says, Dear Dr. Hoffman and Layla, I'm a 60-year-old woman in very good health. I exercise several times a week by mountain biking and hiking. Unfortunately, I'm allergic to poison oak like so many other people. I live in an area of California where it is everywhere. And I've had several severe outbreaks over the last 30 years. Now, it would appear that any time I'm exposed to poison oak, areas of my body where I had severe outbreaks in the past react by breaking out in welts and bumps. Does this make any sense?
Yeah, I mean, it once you've been sensitized to it, you know, even some of the old areas might have sort of a sympathy reaction when your whole body's activated.
Yeah. I was thinking it's
I would look at histamines.
Yeah.
You know, because you might be someone who has trouble breaking down histamines. And, you know, we actually now do genetic testing to see if people have that. But we can measure blood histamines.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Are there vaccines for poison oak? There's some allergy shots that you can take. They don't really work very well.
Hmm.
They're typically only used for people who are very sensitive. So you can investigate that with an allergist.
Yeah.
I'm not a professional allergist, and I don't use these vaccines. I would maybe evaluate this person to see if they're overproducing histamine.
See what's
where we can bring down
there.
The histamine levels. We put people on a low histamine diet. Mm-hmm. We give them DAO, and we give them certain
quercetin
B vitamins, quercetin.
Mm-hmm.
These
to help
are
lower the allergic
sort of
response.
Histamine blockers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. So looking to see if you have histamine, that's a simple blood test, right? So that could be something to look at, Cindy, for you. And yeah, the areas that you're getting reaction by breaking out welts and bumps, it sounds like more allergic reaction too. But you were saying it's a sympathetic reaction.
Well, so the areas that were pre-sensitized are also being activated. So it's like she gets the exposure, it puts her body into overload, the old areas start to flare.
Mm.
But she's on the cusp of being itchy all the time, it sounds like.
Right,
and that's
right.
That sounds very much like a histamine overload situation.
Cindy.
And the external precipitant pushes her over the edge.
Right, right, okay. Cindy, there you have it. Dr. Hoffman's synopsis.
Nice article. If you Google Dr. Ronald Hoffman, histamine intolerance, there's an article I wrote a couple years ago that kind of summarizes that approach.
Terrific.
But there's a lot on the internet these days about histamine intolerance. It's kind of a popular diagnosis in integrative medicine.
It is, right. It's all in vogue now.
Yeah.
Before it was SIBO, but I think SIBO's still happening.
SIBO's still happening.
It's still happening.
Yeah.
And apparently for many other reasons, too,
yep.
Which is interesting. So, okay. We have an email from Larry.
Well, let's save it for part two, because we divide our podcast into two parts.
Yeah.
Give us a preview.
Larry says, I'm really disappointed. I've been taking MK7 for years now, but I've got all this plaque.
Okay, we'll tackle that when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Radioprogram@AOL.com is the destination for questions. That's one word, radioprogram@AOL.com. Send your questions and we'll answer them right here on this forum. This is Intelligent Medicine.